it's wonderful to have you back tonight. But some of you, it will be your first time. So before I introduce tonight's speaker, I just want to tell you a little bit about who we are. What is SALT? We started life together as a group of a few friends who all go to the same church called Grace London that meets here. And what we wanted to do was start to produce content that engaged with some of the questions that Londoners are asking about life. You can check out our articles on our blog, salt.london. But quite quickly, we wanted to bring the conversation into real life. And so we came up with these SALT Live events. And really, these SALT Live events have a couple of different aims, one of which is sometimes we want to engage with the questions and objections that Londoners are asking around the whole question of organized religion and the Christian faith. We've done questions like, does religion poison everything? If God, why suffering? And perhaps on a lighter note, why are Christians so weird about sex? So on one hand, kind of engaging with those questions and criticisms. On the other hand, we want to engage with some of the most fundamental questions around kind of human existence, the kind of deeper questions of life that every Londoner, of whatever background of belief, is asking. And tonight's question, I think you'll agree with me, perhaps is one of the most fundamental questions of human existence. Where do I find lasting happiness? Where do I find lasting satisfaction? Tonight, our speaker, Andrew Haslam, is the pastor of that church called Grace London. But don't hold that against him. He really is something of a brain on a stick. And it's probably no exaggeration to suggest that he has spent many of the last days, perhaps even weeks, hauled away in his study, really engaging with the full gamut of what Western civilization has to say on this subject of happiness and satisfaction. I think it's no question in my mind that you will get your money's worth this evening, not least because tonight is a free event. Now, in all seriousness, Andrew thinks very... tonight, there's no question that in my mind that Andrew thinks deeply about everything he thinks about, and he's got a lot of substance to share with us this evening. So after Andrew speaks, we'll have a chance for some Q&A. So as he's speaking, do note down anything that provokes you, and we'll have a chance to engage on that after he speaks. I think that's everything from me, so why don't you guys put your hands together and give a warm welcome to Andrew.
Oh, not quite brainy enough to deal with this. Just one second. The most gratifying thing about doing these events is that when Jeremy speaks, I get to introduce him. It's payback time always. So it is so good to be with you guys this evening. I have been just anticipating the opportunity to speak on this subject. We set it some months ago, and I knew it was something I wanted to speak on probably for a year or more, that I felt like this was an urgent question really for us. Not only to think about the SALT, but just really when I consider the conversations that I have with people in London and the kinds of issues that are surfacing for people, I'm not sure that there's a more pressing question than this one, because in many ways it's the issue behind all the issues. It's the thing which is underneath a lot of the fermenting problems and concerns and the searchings and the longings and the questions that people have on the surface, and it all comes down to this. And for that reason, it's also a massive subject. And I know that some of you are going to be slightly disappointed at parts, that there isn't more depth here or there. I'm going to try and say as much as I can, as quickly as I can, so that we can open the floor for Q&A afterwards. But I want to just open the subject for us. I read actually only last week in the news magazine, which I get, that economists at the National Bureau of Economic Research have put together data from 132 countries and discovered who the most unhappy people in the world are. And apparently it turns out it's 47.2-year-olds. And looking around this room, it means that for most of you, you're heading towards that moment. That's not behind you, it's in front of you. And so it underlines even more what an important question this is. When I think about the search for happiness, the longing for happiness that we all identify with, I think it explains everything you do. It explains why some of you work too hard, and it explains why some of you try to avoid work. It explains why some of you are in committed relationships, potentially married young, and why others of you would prefer to delay that commitment until as long as possible. Both of you are motivated by the same thing, by the quest for happiness. It explains why some of you hate religion and why some of you are extremely devout in whatever faith you follow. It explains why some of you eat meat and why some of you think that veganism is the way forward. All of our life choices and even our moment-by-moment decisions boil down to this one, the quest and the longing and the search that is true of all of us, that we're looking for happiness. And there's a number of quotes I unearthed from various thinkers down through the ages, and all of them just point to this idea that the most basic human urge is this urge to find happiness. So Aristotle, the Greek philosopher, about over 300 BC, he said, "Happiness is something final and self-sufficient and is the end of action." In other words, it's the reason you do everything. Diderot, who was a French philosopher in the 1700s, said, "There's only one passion, the passion for happiness." William James, who's an American philosopher, and he was also the father of American psychology, so in the 1800s, he said, "How to gain, how to keep, and how to recover happiness is, in fact, for most men at all times, the secret motive of all they do and of all they are willing to endure." And my favorite was Blaise Pascal, who's a French mathematician and a physicist and a theologian, and he was definitely a polymath. He was an inventor as well. In the 1600s, he said this, listen carefully. He said, "All men seek happiness. Whatever different means they employ, they all tend to this end. The cause of some going to war and of others avoiding it is the same desire in both. The will inside you never takes the least step but to this object. Everything you do is to get happiness. This is the motive of every action of every man, even of those who hang themselves." You pause on that thought for a moment and you think about it deeply enough, you'll realize he's right. Even people who commit suicide are doing it in the pursuit of happiness. It seems like the only route left, the only route available. So I want to ask you at the outset, are you happy? When you consider this question, when you look at your own life, are you authentically, genuinely happy? Have you found this happiness that we're thinking about? The problem, as I see it, and the reason why we're addressing this question is because this search for happiness often seems so elusive to many of us, doesn't it? And it was in the 1980s, so this the decade I was born. Got love for you if you were born in the 80s. U2 sang the song that said, you'll know the words, "I've climbed the highest mountains, I have run through the fields only to be with you. I have run, I have crawled, I have scaled these city walls only to be with you." And then famously, "But I still haven't found what I'm looking for." And I think one of the reasons why that song resonated and why it really caused the whole album to explode in popularity was because when you hear that lyric, you know what they're saying. You get it, don't you? "I still haven't found what I'm looking for." That there's a hunger or a search or a thirst or desire for happiness which so many people are after but do not feel they've yet found. What's the reason for that? That's what we're going to be thinking about. The trouble with this quest is that when you're in the search for happiness, you can either find yourself just experiencing deeper and deeper yearning as you explore the depths of how to be happy and why you're not happy and what to do about it. Or at some point you might reach that threshold of despair. And I was reading about this. There was a couple, I'd not heard of them prior to this, but a couple a male and female radio host called John Little and Lynn Rosen, who were psychotherapists and a motivational speaker, who hosted a show in the United States called The Pursuit of Happiness. It was a New York radio show. And in 2013, they were both found dead because they'd entered into a suicide pact together and suffocated one another. And you think, what on earth drives people to that depth of despair? And I think it's that, in a sense, they'd made their whole lives about this pursuit of happiness. It was what was their day job, essentially. And it tells a story, doesn't it, that this is how their search ended. This is where it met its final moment. And this is why I think this is perhaps the most important question we could be asking. And I really can't exaggerate why I think it has to be tackled and thought through. I need to say at the outset, I believe that happiness is possible. I believe it's attainable. I believe it's real. I believe it's a possibility for any of you. So what I want to do is I want to lay out what I see as the four main answers to the question and try and assess them a little bit as we're going along and hopefully bring the threads together a little bit at the end and lay out for you these four avenues. And I'm going to start with the first, which I also think is probably the most obvious. The first answer to the question, the quest for happiness, is hedonism, the kind of the indulgence of desire, hedonism. I would say that this is the most instinctive, the most natural, the most intuitive answer to the question of how you find happiness. Hedonism traces its roots back right into ancient Greece. It was an official philosophy that having pleasure, finding and seeking and fulfilling your pleasures is the way to happiness. But even if it wasn't a philosophy, I don't think you'd even need to give it a name, because in a sense, every single one of you knows this in your gut, that this is the first thing you run to, isn't it, in the pursuit for happiness. It's almost an animalistic urge, the longing to fulfill your desires, the longing to find pleasure, to find things in life which seem to fill you up with joy in that sense. And so it seems to me that in recent decades or over the last century or so, when you look at the Western world and you look particularly at our context in the UK, it seems to me that this is probably the most prominent answer to the question. It wasn't always the case. It used to be the case that in history we were mainly quite constrained by the kind of religious status quo. And as a result, there were so many behaviors and choices that were out of bounds, that were considered taboo, that were considered inappropriate, that would have prevented people from going down different roads in pursuit of pleasure. But of course, with the breaking down of those barriers and the elevation of personal liberty and the fact that you get to choose what you want to do with your time, life, money, body, and all the rest of it, we have thrown ourselves full tilt at hedonism, at pleasure seeking, as the expression of how I want to find happiness. And I'd be certain that there isn't a single one of us, myself included, who hasn't in some way sought to discover happiness by this route at some point in your life, if not right now. The question then I want to ask with you is, does it work? Does hedonism work? Does it lead you to where you want to get to? Does it give you that fulfillment that you are looking for? And I suspect that even in asking the question, all of you are torn. Because on the one hand, you know from past experience that there has not yet been a pleasure in life that you have encountered that has met your longing, that has sort of satisfied you in a permanent and lasting way. You know that's true. But at the same time, you also feel that the sense of holding out hope. It's just because you haven't tried everything yet, right? So there was a Spike Milligan, who was famous some years ago, said, "All I ask is the chance to prove to myself that money can't make you happy." And you could fill in the gap there with any number of things. All I ask is the chance to prove to myself that sex can't make you happy, or that fame can't make you happy, or that whatever other thing. It's all very well for you who have tried it to now tell me it didn't make you happy, but it's my turn. I get to try this, right? We have that suspicion. We believe that if anyone's telling us this doesn't work, you think, no, basically it didn't work for you, but it will for me. So how are we going to think about this rigorously? How do we analyze this? And I think the easiest way to think about hedonism or pleasure seeking and trying to put it under the microscope and assess whether it works or not is to actually think about the effect of wealth. And the reason why I would put it there is because what is wealth? Wealth in and of itself is somewhat meaningless. It doesn't really make any difference to your life in the present moment whether you have a large sum or a small sum in the bank, or whether you have a lot of cash or no cash in your pocket. The reason we pursue wealth is because of what it can give to us, the luxuries, the pleasures that it can buy. And the more money you have, the fewer boundaries there are to pleasure, right? And the less money you have, the more difficulty there is in attaining the pleasure that you want in life. So I think the easiest way to assess whether hedonism works or not is to ask the question, well, does wealth make you happy? And what's the answer to that question. The answer is sort of, but no. Now, you can check this out for yourself. The literature is very clear on this subject. That when people are poor, when they don't have all that they need, the lack of money definitely affects their well-being. And giving a person a higher income to the point where they get everything they need definitely increases their level of contentment and happiness and well-being in life. But as soon as they have everything they need, let's say they get to that kind of middle-class lifestyle where the things you have are enough, at that point, any excess money beyond that has very small, marginal gains in delivering any extra happiness. And this is very well documented, it's proven, and the psychologists, as far as I can tell, are completely agreed on this subject. Why? What's going on there? Because, I mean, on the surface of it, it just doesn't really have the ring of truth to us, does it? We think, clearly, the more you have, the happier you're going to be. And I think there are a couple of reasons that are given on this one. One of them is this thing that the psychologists call adaptation. Adaptation simply means this, that when your circumstances change, you quickly adapt to those circumstances. Humans have this extraordinary capacity to adapt to changing circumstances. Now, put it before you an option here. If somebody gave you the choice between becoming a paraplegic, so unable to move from the neck down, or winning the lottery, what would you choose and why? The answer, obviously, you choose to win the lottery. And the answer, I think the reason you give it is because that will make you happy and the other route would make you deeply unhappy. And the fascinating thing is that if you actually trace the stories of people who've gone through these experiences, it's true that in the beginning, the lottery winner will experience an extraordinary amount of elation and that the paraplegic will experience amazing sadness, depression, and struggle through the early days of suffering in this way. But what's also, actually I think even what is absolutely incredible is that within a year, these two people will have returned to their normal state of happiness. I find that an absolutely extraordinary thing, with only a very slight difference between them. And the reason that's given for this is this thing called adaptation. It's something that works against you when you're trying to make your life better by adding new things. You know, you get your new phone and you think this is going to absolutely fulfill my life. And of course, within a few weeks, it's just as boring as the old one. I mean, we bought a new TV earlier this month. And my wife and I have been married for like 12 and a half years. We've never bought a TV. We've had cast-offs that people have given to us. And we finally bought this thing. And I was like, this is it. We've arrived. And of course, what I know, because I've read the stuff, of course, this thing doesn't add to my happiness. All it will do, it'll be just as exciting as the old TV eventually. And of course, that's what happens. These things wear off because of adaptation. It also works for you, of course, when you suffer. Most forms of suffering you can adapt to. There are some exceptions, like degenerative conditions, but most forms of suffering you can adapt to. And this whole idea of adaptation means that it's very hard to increase your well-being simply by being wealthier or by adding more pleasures to your life. The other reason the psychologists give for this one is what they call the hedonic treadmill. Now, you know what happens when you step on a treadmill? You run harder and harder and harder, but you don't move. You don't get anywhere as a result. And this is what happens when you give your life over to hedonism, when you give your life to pleasure seeking. To begin with, pleasures deliver. But within a short time, you become accustomed to that amount of pleasure. You want more. In order to get the delivery, you need more. And this is obvious, you know, when you think about drug use, it's the obvious example here, that you need a higher high. But it's true in all of our lives. You think about the thrill of sex. There was a time, so we've heard, that a man would be thrilled by the glimpse of an ankle in the Victorian era, right? But you know, how many 15-year-old boys in our day and age are going to be thrilled by that? Because they've seen so much more. The hedonic treadmill tells you you need more and more and more pleasure in order just to stand still. And of course, when you put wealth into the mix, wealth just speeds up the treadmill. It just allows you to have more and more of your heart's desires to the point where you need more in order just to stand still. And of course, this is a proven thing. This is not something I'm just making up on the spot. This is absolutely documented. This is what people observe in human nature. I want to add a third issue here, though, a kind of strike against hedonism. Now, this is not one I've read about. This is just one I understand from my own life and also from talking with others. I think there's a third element here, which is guilt. You can take it or leave it, but it seems to me that too much indulgence tends to leave you feeling dirty and defiled, doesn't it? And you think about, you know, even if it's something as ordinary as eating too much or emptying that tub of ice cream, you don't feel better as a result, do you? And it seems to me that there are no pleasures in life which you can indulge to the max without, or very few, that without feeling in some way like you've messed up, right? Now, this failure of hedonism is something which has been understood and known since really the dawn of time. And there's a whole book in the Bible devoted to the subject, written by, we think, by Solomon, king, son of David. And the book is called Ecclesiastes. He says at one point in that book, and he's describing how he lived life to the max to see what would happen. He says, "Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them." And you read in the rest of the book the kinds of things he desired and the kinds of things he filled his life with. He says, "I kept from my heart no pleasure." And then he says, "Then I considered all that my hands had done, all the toil that I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun." He says, the more I filled up on pleasure and tried to find this contentment through the things that I could have access to, he was probably the wealthiest man in the world at the time, the more he did that, he said, the more it just seemed to fall through his fingers like air. It was just vanity. It was emptiness. It was futility. And of course, as I said earlier, it's hard to believe unless you've tried it for yourself. But that's hedonism for you. Making pleasure your goal in life does not make you happier. And in fact, it can have the opposite effect. It can lead you to making huge mistakes. You think about the guy, you know, married with three kids who, in the desire for pleasure, sleeps with the secretary or whatever and then ends up in an extramarital affair. And what does he do? He blows his life up. His yearning for pleasure actually has made his life worse in the long run, though he didn't see it to begin with. Hedonism, that's the first thing. Let me bring to you a second avenue. This one is a little bit more difficult. This is the option of philosophy, and I'll put it like this, it's the denial of desire. So if hedonism was the indulgence of desire, the philosophers have offered us a second option, which is the denial of desire. Now, I think in many ways this is a reaction to the failure of hedonism, and it's given birth to a number of philosophies and worldviews that are a reaction to it, and a couple of them I want to mention to you that have become increasingly kind of revived and repopularized in our day and age. One of them is Stoicism. You've heard of the ancient Greek Stoics. And the other is Buddhism, which they're different, obviously, worldviews, but they share a number of things in common. They're both atheistic. They both sort of champion virtues as the better way of living your life instead of pursuing pleasure. And they both have in common this core philosophy, which is this idea that's called detachment or non-attachment, which basically says that in order to be happy, you can't rely on external factors. You can't rely on success. You can't rely on a relationship. You can't rely on the pleasures of life because those things come and go and you can't control them. In order to be content, you have to find happiness within yourself by being non-attached or detached from the things of this world. The Stoics taught it, and the Greeks and the Buddhists taught it. So Stoicism, as I told you, arose in ancient Greek. It was the teaching of a man called Zeno, and more famously Marcus Aurelius, who is the emperor in Gladiator. If you like the film, he's the old emperor in Gladiator. So he wrote his sort of Meditations, which has really been it's been a best-selling book for many millennia now. And what essentially these guys believe has been distilled in a number of modern books, but I was reading Derren Brown's book. You know, Derren Brown, the magician. He's written an interesting book on happiness, and I'll leave you to judge whether you think it's a particularly happy book or not. But I wasn't so sure. And he describes this philosophy in this way. He says, "We are at the mercy of constant influences from without that pull or nudge us this way or that. He says, this is the antithesis of a life where our center of gravity is rooted within ourselves. In the centered life, work, health, family, and friends still make their demands, but we can acknowledge and entertain those forces without feeling them imposed directly upon our core selves. So if you want a picture, I think what he's saying is something like this. He's saying that your life needs to be like a castle, well-stocked and with a drawbridge. And all the things of this life, be it relationships, be it success, your fame, your wealth, whatever it is, all those things are around you outside the castle. And in order to be happy, you need to be able to pull up the drawbridge so that you have contentment, so you have self-sufficiency, so that you have a perfect tranquility within yourself. You're a centered person, and that's how we become happy, he says. Buddhists teach something similar, and the story of Gautama Buddha was that he was a prince in India, and his father did not want him to encounter any form of suffering. So he had every pleasure imaginable, and he was kept closed up within the palace walls without ever being exposed to the sufferings and the realities of life until one day he got out. And upon seeing suffering, he began to wrestle with the problem of suffering, and he came to the conclusion that all of life is suffering. And his answer to that was similar to the Stoics, but much earlier. He taught the same idea that if life is suffering, the way we find happiness is through ridding ourselves of the attachments to the things of this world. And of course, his way was through meditation and other Buddhist practices, but it's essentially the same core idea. The only way you can be happy is by not needing anything, by not desiring anything, by not being vulnerable to anything or anyone, but having a perfect tranquility within yourself. There was an 8th century Chinese Zen master called Sen San who wrote a poem which kind of captures this. It says, "The perfect way is only difficult for those who pick and choose. Do not like, do not dislike. All will then be clear. Make a hairbreadth difference." In other words, the minute you start picking and choosing between good and bad, he says, "and heaven and earth are set apart. But if you want the truth to stand clear before you, never be for or against. The struggle between for and against is the mind's worst disease." And what he's trying to depict for us is this picture of a person who has perfect tranquility because they neither like nor dislike. They don't choose or not choose. They're totally immovable in their peace and happiness that's within themselves. I thought, well, what do we make of this? I think it was a little bit easier to kind of pull hedonism apart, but what do you make of this idea, which is almost its very opposite, isn't it? How do we deal with this? Does it make any sense to us? And it's a really important question because a lot of people are advocating these routes and walking down these routes in our day and age. And I want to say a few things. I think, first of all, it denies your humanity. Our desires and emotions, I know, can be harmful. It's possible to be overly dependent on the things of this world for joy. It's possible to feel emotions which cause you massive unhappiness, like anger or powerful lust or these kinds of things. But our emotions are also, and our desires are part of our humanity, aren't they? So you think about the example of sex. Buddha said, "So long as lustful desire, however small, of man for woman is not controlled, so long the mind of man is not free, but is bound like a calf to a cow." And I'll be honest with you. I desire my wife. I've got 3 children to prove it. And what do you think it would make? What would it do to my marriage if I were to fully agree with the Buddha there, that that desire has to be completely squashed, controlled, eradicated? What would it do to humanity? Another example came from a Greek Stoic called Epictetus, talking about love. He said this, "What harm is there while you are kissing your child to murmur softly, 'Tomorrow you will die'?" I don't know if I have to answer the question for him, but But what he's saying is, listen, if you love your child too much, if your joy is too dependent upon your child, that will only lead to grief. And of course, there's some sense in that, especially in the ancient world where perhaps the majority of your children would die before you. You can understand where he's coming from. It's easiest to withdraw. It's easiest to pull up the drawbridge and just completely detach yourself from the things of this world. But doesn't that also make you less human? Doesn't it also somehow diminish your humanity? Another problem I have with this is I think it distances us from reality. If life is suffering, which is what the Buddha said, then why try and reduce it? Doesn't it lead to a passivity against the injustices and the social problems that you see in the world around you if you just say life is suffering and we just have to find tranquility and peace within our own hearts? I find it interesting that one of the most famous Buddhists alive today, the Dalai Lama, who's kind of the head of Tibetan Buddhism, and also exiled to India, where because of China's occupation of Tibet, it's interesting to me that he spent decades of his life in negotiations with the Chinese for the liberation of Tibet. And what is that if it's not attachment? And wouldn't we think less of him if he was truly detached from the desire to help his own nation? In other words, I don't think it really works in the real world. And that if you were truly consistent in this, you'd have to deny reality, you'd have to deny suffering, you'd have to deny the problems of the world. I'd also add this, I don't think it agrees with the evidence. Now, I got this from reading an amazing book by Jonathan Haidt, who's an American psychologist, and the book is The Happiness Hypothesis, and we're going to get onto some of his stuff in a moment. But he says, I mean, he has a lot of admiration for Stoicism and Buddhism, but he says they took things too far. Because what they didn't see and what psychology has now shown us is that there are lots of external factors in your life which do contribute to your happiness. Things in your life are not the problem, in other words. So we've looked at hedonism, the indulgence of desire. We looked at philosophy and the denial of desire. I want to take you to a third thing, which is psychology and the study of desire. Psychology and the study of desire. Now, there's been a huge amount of progress on the question of happiness. Among psychologists, there was a time when the field of psychology, which is a relatively new field in its official form, there was a time when psychology was entirely devoted to pathologies, to sickness, mental sickness or illness. But over the last few decades, a man called Martin Seligman has pioneered what he calls positive psychology, which is the research into what makes humans flourish, what makes your life happy, and they've made some massive progress in understanding humans, in understanding what makes us tick and what makes us live fulfilled, flourishing, and happy lives. And the research is fascinating. But one of the ways you can get a handle on it, it's too much to summarize really, but one of the ways you can get a handle on it is that Seligman has reduced it down to a formula. Who knew that happiness was a formula? I'm about to give it to you, so take notes. He says that happiness is equal to is a sum of three things, S plus C plus V. And these three things are these. S is what they call your biological set point, your genetic predisposition towards a particular level of happiness. C is your conditions, so things that you maybe can change, like how wealthy you are, or the relationships you're in, or the location you live in, all those kinds of things. And things you can't change, like your race, your age, your sex, your ability or disabilities, these kinds of things. So your conditions. And the third thing is V, your voluntary activities. So what you do with your time, what you choose to do, whether you choose to go out bike riding or watching TV or what it is you do with your time, okay? Now, immediately when you think about this, so happiness is your biology, plus your conditions, plus your activities, your voluntary activities. Immediately, you'll have spotted the bad news for some of you, which is your biology. The bad news is that what they've discovered is that your happiness is largely, to the majority of it, determined by your genes. Something like 50 to 80% of your happiness level determined by your genetics. Now, this is absolutely, since I read this, it's actually become completely obvious to me within my own family. There's no secret between me and my wife who is the melancholic, which is me, and who's happy, which is her. It's obvious to anyone who knows us. I'm naturally a pessimist. She's naturally optimistic. And the fascinating thing, as I told you, we had three kids, and the youngest is only a few months old, but the older two are 6 and 4, a boy and a girl. And it's fascinating to see these traits come through, and they've been with them since they were babies, actually. My boy is like me. I've been wrestling with him for 2 years trying to get him to his swimming lessons. Every day, every week when I bring him to swimming lesson, it begins with, I don't want to go swimming, I don't want to go swimming. And he talks like this over dinner, and then it gradually builds up until sometimes he cries. And every single time, he has an absolutely amazing time. And I've at times resorted to filming him at the end of his swimming lesson. I'd be like, can you just record a message for your future self telling you how much you enjoyed this? But every single week, it doesn't even matter if I show it to him, every single time, it builds up this fear, this anxiety, this withdrawal from something that pushes him outside of his comfort zone. And some kids are just like that. He's like that. I certainly have those tendencies and traits. Imagine how much happiness I lost preparing for this event, for example. Now, my daughter, on the other hand, is a completely different person. She is pure optimism personified. Like, she's 4 years old. You know, a few months ago, before she'd learned to write, she would get out her notebook, which someone gave her, and she'd just write scribbles. And C would try and tell her, she'd say, I'm writing a story, Mummy. And she'd narrate her story. And C was like, I don't think that's English. You're not writing anything. She says, don't worry about it. It's all going to be fine. And she'd just read it to us. And like just last week, C was trying to reprimand her. She said to her, listen, you need to be kind to your friends. If you're not kind to your friends, they won't want to come to your parties. And, you know, Isla's a party girl. She'll dress up. The idea of a party just lights up her world. So, but her instant retort was, they will, because I'll give them cake. And C replied, well, that might not be enough. What if they don't want your cake? And she says, I'm going to ask them what cakes they want. Don't worry. So she has this, like, totally impenetrable optimism. You can't get the girl down. There's nothing that's too scary for her. And they were just born this way. There wasn't anything we did. They just came out different. And this is true of us, and that's the bad news, right? You have a biological set point, and the amount of happiness you can or can't experience in life works around a range around your biological set point. And some people are just win what they call the cortical lottery. Their brains are just wired to be much happier than others of us. And that's just the way it is. So good news for some of you, I know. The good news, though, is this, that what they've discovered is that there are things you can do to improve your life. And I want to think with you about some of these things for just a moment. Jonathan Haidt, who wrote this book in the early 2000s, put it like this. He says, happiness is not something that you can find, acquire, or achieve directly. You have to get the conditions right and then wait. Just as plants need sun, water, and good soil to thrive, people need love, work, and a connection to something larger. Now, I can't do justice to the whole book. There's many, many provocative ideas in there. But really, the very final chapter, he draws together some of his threads and says, really, the two main conditions that affect your sense of happiness are love and work. And this is what he says about them. He says, love, essentially, the idea of romantic love is a myth. We all know it. We're kind of suspicious of that being true. But he says, no, it's documented. It's obviously true that it's a myth. What you really need in life is committed love, family, friends, and ideally a spouse as well, where you have this deep, committed love. And this bears out in one of the most demonstrated, proved, robust theories that's lasted well over 100 years now and been proven by multiple studies, which is a guy called Emil Durkheim. He came up with this theory where he said that basically there's a correlation between people's well-being and the amount of constraints that tie them to commitments, like responsibility, like family and friends and community. And what you see is that where these constraints evaporate, where you no longer have these obligations, marriage is an obvious one, but it's also other things, the structures, the kind of fibers that make your life bound to others and make society thick. Where those constraints disappear, you see happiness plummet and suicide rates go up. Now, he speculated about this back in the 1800s, and all the evidence has shown that he's been absolutely right. And Jonathan Haidt wraps it up in this way, on this one, this theme of love. He says, we need to interact and intertwine with others. We need the give and the take. We need to belong. An ideology of extreme personal freedom can be dangerous because it encourages people to leave homes, jobs, cities, and marriages in search of personal and professional fulfillment, thereby breaking the relationships that were probably their best hope for such fulfillment. And I say that knowing that in this room, most of us have done that exact thing. The majority of you not born in London, majority of you found your way to this city, you know, doing something which is, would have been very unusual in the history of the world or in the history of our nation, which is leaving your community, your family, in the pursuit of personal liberty. And he says, in many ways, that's the worst possible thing you can do for your happiness and well-being. I find that fascinating. I don't think it means that you're doomed in any way. I believe that there are antidotes to that. And that finding community and commitment within a city is perfectly possible. But it ought to make you think. He says love, and the other big condition is work. There's a lot we can say about this, but I want to just say this to you very, very quickly. He says work can massively enrich your life if it meets certain conditions. If you regularly experience what Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, who's a Hungarian US psychologist, describes as flow, which is like that perfect balance of challenge in the work you do, but also of being able to do it where you the time gets lost and you just get absorbed in your work. And you can see that people experience their work in different ways. For some people, it's just a job where it's just about getting your paycheck and going home. For other people, it's a career where you have an ambition, but you, at the end of the day, you ask yourself if you're working too hard. But he says that when people experience their most happiness through work, it's when they experience work as a calling, which is to say that you know the greater reason for which you do it, and you'd even do it for free if the circumstances forced you to. Now, I find all this stuff like massively interesting. But it also raises a bunch of questions for me. And I just want to give you, throw two at you on this point. I do believe that life can be happier when it's lived well, when it's lived wisely, when you have the right things in your life. And I think there's a lot of ways that modern life is structured that actually militate against our well-being and that we do well to go against the flow. But the problem I have with some of these conclusions are, let me just give you two. One is this, that this approach only seems to work when you have full control. And the reality is that for many people, then they don't get to choose whether they find that level of love and commitment in their life, or whether they find the calling which they would so love to find. It's like you don't know what to do that would give you that sense of fulfillment. And a lot of people through history and even in the world today never even get to make those choices to begin with. So it seems to me to be an inadequate answer to the question of happiness to say, hey, you've got to get all these things exactly right and then suddenly watch the plant grow and flourish. I'm not saying you shouldn't pursue those things, but I find it to be a problematic way of approaching the question. And I also want to add this hesitation as well. I still think that even if you say, you know, you read all the literature and you get your life in order and you put everything in place, all the conditions that you need, you know, you don't have to commute to work, there's no noise outside your flat, you know, these are real things he mentions, there's, you know, all this kind of stuff, you get everything right. Even then, you may have this gaping hole, which is the quest for meaning. Because fundamentally, the human heart is a meaning. It is thirsty for meaning, desperate to find meaning. We're meaning makers. We create narratives of our existence. We understand our whole lives within the framework of a story. And even if you get all the conditions in your life right, you may not feel that your thirst or your itch to find meaning is fulfilled. Now, I say that because, you know, I waded through Haidt's 550-page book on the subject of happiness, right? And when you get to the end, on almost the last page, he concedes that he doesn't have an inspiring answer to the question of meaning. And I'm not disparaging him because I think it's an awesome book and I recommend you read it, but I found that really interesting. And he gets to that point at the end of the book where he says, listen, I don't have an inspiring answer to the question of meaning. And then he says this. He says it's worth striving to get the right relationships between yourself and others, between yourself and your work, and between yourself and something larger than yourself. He says if you get these relationships right, a sense of purpose and meaning will emerge. And I found that left me frustrated because of the inadequacy of that conclusion. Does meaning just emerge? The reality is I've known many people for whom they've got all the things in place. They have the job, they have the relationship, they have the family, and meaning has not emerged. It doesn't just emerge. And you can't create meaning and feel in your heart that it is meaningful. The second it's made by you, you know that it's empty, that it's vacuous, that it's not real. So I want to bring you to my final thought, which is about faith and the fulfillment of desire. And I'll deal with this very briefly. It will surprise you to know that the Bible, let me just pull a little one out here. The Bible, that's like a magic trick, wasn't it? The Bible has an enormous amount to say on the question of happiness. You've heard of the Psalms. The Psalms are the kind of prayer book of the scriptures. And the very first Psalm opens on the question of happiness. It uses the language of blessedness, but blessedness just means happiness. It says, blessed or happy is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. And he says he's like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season. Now, you might disagree with the kind of hypothesis that's laid out there, the idea that living a righteous life will lead to happiness and this kind of flourishing. Whether you disagree or not is not my point. My point is that the Bible everywhere speaks of the question of happiness, and that this is a massively prominent issue within Christianity. Now, how does the Bible then expect us to answer this question? And it helps us answer it at two levels. The first level is the claim that righteous living works. And in many ways, this pulls together all the threads of everything I've said to you tonight. It pulls together the thread of the kind of positive psychology, the idea that if you have the conditions in your life right, you flourish. And in the Bible, that's the image of the wise person or the righteous person as opposed to the fool who acts foolishly and impulsively and all those kinds of things. And in the psalm I just read to you, or the part I read to you, the picture is of a tree planted by streams of living water. It grows robust and strong. It's in contrast, he says, to chaff, which is kind of the dust that comes off wheat that just blows away in the wind. He says, you've got two choices in life. And I think that kind of agrees with everything that Jonathan Haidt and other psychologists have said about the conditions of your life. When your life is lived well, there's a sense in which you experience happiness. There's also agreement to some extent with the Stoics and the Buddhists in this sense. The Bible teaches us to shun short-term pleasures, impulsive, self-destructive pleasure, in preference for long-term joy. And that's a massive theme throughout the Bible. There's a difference there about how you get it, but it's huge. The Bible teaches us about the blessings of the externals that the Buddhism disparages as gifts from God, like love and children and work and your home and all these kinds of things. But it also teaches you not to elevate them too high, to turn them into idols, because as soon as they become idols in your life, they're your downfall. So it puts your desires in their place. Yes, it affirms desire, but also puts it into proportion, and it helps you understand how desire can be managed, controlled, and contained. And there's even agreement in the Bible with the idea of hedonism to a certain extent, and that'll surprise you. But the Bible's very clear. I mean, Christians often have reputation as being killjoys and of imposing all kinds of arbitrary rules in order to destroy happiness. But this is actually massively in contradiction to what the Bible says about God himself, that he is happy, and also that every pleasure that we enjoy on earth is created by him, that he's the giver of all joy. You remember the first miracle that Jesus ever performed was turning water into wine at a wedding. Why, if not to let the joy flow? The Bible ends with a feast. It ends with a kind of celebration, a massive feast at the end of time. And you think, these are not the symbols of a morose, ascetic, kind of pleasure-denying religion. These are saying, no, there's a place for joy and for pleasure. And so there's that sense in which The question within Christianity is answered at those levels. It says all these things have an element of truth, and we can pull them all together to paint the picture of the happy, fulfilled life. However, there's another level at which we answer this. The Bible talks about a kind of a deeper happiness, which isn't reliant upon your circumstances. And this is because there have been many situations of Christians through the ages, and Christians even in my own experience, and even very close to me, where happiness has to be something that you enjoy even in spite of your circumstances. Sometimes that's because Christians themselves have been persecuted and suffered immensely for the cost of being called Christian. Sometimes it's because just stuff happens, right? Life is full of pain and suffering. And yet it's possible to have joy despite that, when all the conditions of your life are wrong, when you have no pleasures, when nothing's going well. It's still possible to have happiness. It's still possible to be fundamentally a joyful person. And you ask the question, how? And the answer is to go back to your desires. This paragraph from C.S. Lewis, it captures it so perfectly. He says, creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. He says, a baby feels hunger. Well, there is such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there's such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desires. Well, there's such a thing as sex. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. In other words, what Christianity teaches is that your desires are not the problem. If anything, they're more like a signpost. The fact that you have hunger or thirst or an insatiable longing to find contentment and happiness and peace at last, it's a pointer that there's something that you have not yet discovered, that you were in a sense made for another world, that there is something eternal and transcendent that is meant to fill your heart. And this, of course, is what has been the experience and the reality for so many Christians through the ages. Perhaps one of the most famous examples of this was St. Augustine. Augustine lived in the Roman Empire in the 300s. And in North Africa, he gave his life to all kinds of hedonistic pleasure. He slept with whoever he went with. He lived a kind of party lifestyle, and he found this horrible emptiness at the center of his being. He gave himself to philosophy. He studied the philosophers. He was a smart man, very clever man, and he still found this emptiness. And he wrote probably what is the first autobiography in history. It's called his Confessions. And on page one of Augustine's Confessions, he describes how he arrived at tranquility. And he's talking to God as he writes. And he writes this line. He says, "You have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you." Now, there was more I wanted to say on this, but my time is gone. And I want to just leave you with that thought as we close. Now, please, I'm going to hand back to Jeremy, actually. So go for it, my friend.
Why don't you join me in giving Andrew a round of applause.